Blog Talk Radio.
University, where I also teach philosophy. I am joined tonight by two students who regularly do ethics talk, Ms. Sandra Joy Russell.
Hello.
And Mr. Nicholas Brousseau.
Hello.
And also we are joined by a very special guest, Ms. Anya Kamenetz. Hello, Anya.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us. If you're not aware of who Anya Kamenetz is, Anya graduated from Yale in 2002. She is a journalist and an author. Her first book, Generation Debt, was published in 2006 by Riverhead, and she is currently working on a book called Hacking Education, which will be published in 2010 by Chelsea Green. And tonight's conversation is basically on what she's writing about for her forthcoming book. And some of what she is writing about was recently the subject of an article that she wrote for Fast Company called How Web-Savvy Edupunks Are Transforming American Higher Education. Basically, the objective of tonight's show is to discuss with Anya, who's really is at the center of this discussion. Our objective is to discuss the promises and the perils of the marriage between higher education, technology, and the internet. And so if you're interested in calling, we will be taking calls. The number is 646-727-3928. In addition, if you check our website, ethicstalk.cmish.edu, you will find a link to Anya's article from Fast Company, as well as some information about her book, Generation Debt, a link to her blog, etc. That's at ethicstalk.cmish.edu. Just click on Show Resources. So, Anya, again, thanks so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule. And let me just first begin by introducing the audience to your work with Generation Debt and the columns that you were working on out of which that book arose. That book chronicled the financial plight of the average college undergrad, and basically you were bringing to light for people the fact that so many students are graduating with college degrees with dismal job prospects, and it's even worse now. That book was published in 2006. Dismal job prospects, but also in debt. Debt that is unbelievable. I know of one student who graduated from CMU with a bachelor's degree, $60,000 in debt. I'm sure that's not uncommon. And now, is it safe to say that your beat now is on technology and higher education?
Well, I'd like to describe kind of the bridge from, you know, what Generation Debt was trying to do and what I'm trying to do with this new book. You know, as you pointed out, I really became one of the people who was most active in talking about, you know, student loan debt and the sort of the promise, you know, the disjunction between the promise of what a higher education was supposed to be delivered to people, which was, you know, financial freedom and also personal freedom, the ability to kind of pursue your dreams, the disjunction between that promise and sort of the reality of very high debt and limited prospects. And looking beyond, you know, the immediate issue of student loan debt, I kind of had to ask the question, well, why is it that college tuition keeps going up? And just as important, you know, as tuition keeps going up, why is it that people keep needing to or wanting to pay for it? You know, what is it that is so important in modern life that we feel that, almost everyone needs to get some kind of post-secondary education? And so it was really those two questions that led me to this new book, which is really asking how is college going to transform? How is college going to meet these challenges as an institution of delivering access to so many more people that need it, as well as addressing this incredible cost spiral?
Right, and so your article for Fast Company, you definitely, it seems like you see something very positive with the internet in connection with the whole cost issue, because you talk about things like Academic Earth, podcasts, and this wealth of information that's basically free. So is it safe
right.
to say that like that's, you know, one of the promises that you see that the internet is delivering to higher education?
Yeah, I think that we can all agree that, you know, we live in a world where knowledge is no longer scarce, so it's no longer limited by things like production costs or printing costs, and it's no longer locked up in libraries. So knowledge being very, very much more widely available. And not to, you know, the word free has a lot of different connotations, and I want to emphasize the idea that people that are creating cultural value, and that includes teachers and writers, you know, they can and should be compensated for that work. But what is free is really the ability to reproduce this information and to share it freely, to remix it. And that is kind of the brave new world that we're living in. And what's concerned me is I feel like the educational institutions have not fully caught up to the promise that is entailed by all of this free knowledge and information.
Yeah, and as somebody who works at a college, I would concur with that. And I just want to, before I turn it over to Nick, who will ask you some more questions about the article, I just wanted to just, you know, share with, I think, Anya, you already know this, but share to the viewer how the show even came about. And how the show came about is that I have a Twitter account, and I follow the National Association of Independent Colleges and Universities. They posted a tweet to Anya's article for Fast Company. They didn't say who wrote it. They just had the title.
Huh.
I clicked on the link. It's just the title. I clicked on the link. I started reading it. I thought, wow, this is really good. Who wrote this? And I saw that Anya had written it. And Anya was actually a guest of the Ethics Center in 2007. And so I was very excited reading the article. And you just seem like a natural person to come on the show. So that is how, you know, this show came about. And this show, also Ethics Talk, is a way that we are using here at Southern Michigan University, something free, which is Blog Talk Radio, to promote certain educational objectives that I hold very dear and important. On that note, I'm going to turn over to Nick. And so, Nick?
Yeah. One of the things you guys were just talking about is how the internet offers this kind of like free medium for information, and it's not scarce or locked up in a library, as you said. But in terms of the library, going on that, I was thinking about the Good Will Hunting movie, if you've ever seen it. It's Matt Damon's defending Ben Affleck and against this Harvard guy who's regurgitating this information about something or other. And, you know, Matt Damon kind of shows him up and says, hey, you know, what's funny is that you could have just spent, you know, $1.50 on a library card and I could have gotten the same information gotten the same information that you're getting for, you know, $100,000 or whatever you're paying for that. And I guess I was just kind of curious what you think about in going at knowledge from, like, just the standpoint of, like, taking the information in, I guess.
I thought about that, Steve. I think that's really interesting that you bring that up because, you know, there's kind of a dichotomy in the way that we perceive education, what education is all about, because I think, you know, on the one hand, you have this image of the heroic autodidact, right? Like Matt Damon is really someone who has this thirst for knowledge, this thirst for education, and he's just been able to sort of teach himself and pull himself up by his bootstraps, and that is something that is extremely, you know, it's important, and it's something that, you know, should be available, and that, you know, open educational resources like the MIT Open Courseware Consortium make that kind of autodidacticism much more available. But at the same time, that's not the whole part and parcel of what we think of as education, right? I mean, I think, you know, the story of that movie, again, is you know, Matt Damon being initiated into Harvard. He has this relationship with this, you know, with the therapist, and he learns the missing piece of his education, which was actually being able to relate to people. And I think that that is just as important a part of the puzzle, and that is something that you can't limit education to what people can get by taking in information by themselves. It's something that actually always happens in community, and when it's best, it happens, you know, in groups of people in dialogue.
Yeah. Okay, I just had to bring that up because it just seemed relevant to kind of where we're at. You quote Jose Ferreira, and he's the founder and CEO of Newton. What is Newton?
Newton is a startup, and the idea is that it's basically a tutoring program, a really massive tutoring program, and it kind of follows along, follows you along as a learner as you're trying out information and answering questions, and it sort of adapts to you as you learn.
Cool. This Jose guy, Ferreira, claims that the Internet disrupts any industry whose core product can be reduced to ones and zeros. What do you think that means exactly? I kind of want to hear your
I mean, Ferreira is really speaking about a lot of these cultural industries that we've seen that have been, you know, very upended by the Internet. Everything from, you know, obviously the recording industry to movies to journalism, which is something that's very near and dear to my heart.
Whether you agree or disagree with this claim and with his assumption about the nature of higher education, do you think I'm sorry, I'm kind of losing my train here.
Well, I mean, I guess a lot of people would object to the idea that, you know, education is a knowledge industry, that it's an industry at all, and secondly, as we said, you know, can it really be boiled down to ones and zeros? And I think that, you know, we can kind of both agree that it's not necessarily that those things, but it's interesting. I mean, one thing I've learned in working on this book is that education really is so many different things to different people, and at different times in your life, it might be different things. You know, and sometimes, you know, there's always moments when you just need to know what you need to know to pass the course. You know, and Newton has, you know, Ferreira's background is in test preparation, so things like the SATs and the ACTs, where it really is about just drilling and getting that knowledge into your head, and it's very commodified. But then, of course, there's other, you know, very different dimensions of education, which have to do with, again, with forming relationships, with learning about how to think and how you learn. And those are things that are not really reducible to the same kind of a simple exchange.
Right. I'm curious if there's any research on, like, how to test those kinds of other things.
Well, that's a really interesting question, right? Because I think, you know, in this debate over, you know, is it possible, right, for college to escape the double-digit tuition increases that we've been seeing for 30 years. And one objection that people always raise is they say, well, there's so many things that are intangible about the college experience, we don't really know what's valuable about them. And that's one of the reasons it's so hard to really challenge the model. But personally, I don't really think that the idea that these are intangible values should be enough of an excuse not to look at them and not to look at their value and not to reassess if there are different ways of delivering the same benefits.
Let's discuss a different claim that you make in the article, which is by David Wiley. Who is David Wiley?
David Wiley is really interesting. He is a professor at Brigham Young University, and he's sort of a foremost figure in this open education movement. And so he's been really active in things like getting free open source textbooks released and published, open courseware, free courses. He's opened up his own courses online to anyone on the Internet who wants to take them. So he's just a really interesting voice on these issues.
All right, and he says that if universities can't find the will to adapt to changes in the world around them, they will be irrelevant by 2020.
Right.
Is that claim?
I think, you know, and Wiley has gotten, you know, in trouble himself for making this pronouncement. You know, I think that the university is one of the oldest institutions in our whole civilization. So, you know, the idea that it's going to wither away and suddenly die is probably not a non-starter. But I do think that, I believe that the ways that we exchange information have so profoundly changed over the last 20 years that it would be really surprising if the ways that we transmit our information to, you know, from one generation to the next, i.e. education, if that doesn't change as well. And if the institutions that are currently at the top of the heap don't want to take a good hard look at how to incorporate these technologies, then that gap is going to be filled by new kinds of institutions and even new things that aren't even institutions at all.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of what I think about it. I think the universities are going to have to change. I think there's this kind of, in my mind, that, you know, they're kind of there to give you this information. And now that this information is not esoteric and it's available on the Internet, you know, I think that the universities will have to redefine themselves and kind of what their purpose is.
Exactly.
The role of
exactly.
Blood.
I mean, this, yeah.
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Well, I just something that's really interesting that I've learned in researching this book about the history of the institution is that universities have kept growing and growing and growing. You know, now you have almost 1/5 of the world's population of young people that is enrolled in institutions of higher learning around the world. And the reason it keeps growing is that there's a sort of, it means so many different things to different people in different contexts at different times that it always seems to find justification. But what the Internet does is it really, it disaggregates, it unbundles those benefits. And so I think universities are going to find that they are going to have to abandon the idea of being all things to all people, and they're going to have to focus very specifically on what it is they really do well.
I was just going to say that I think it really goes back to that, what you said, that education is different for everybody. And for me, I mean, my experience as an undergrad was a lot of it was discussion-based. And I think with the Internet, I think you lose that. And so all you're receiving is, like, pure knowledge. And I just feel like there's something valuable that comes in, like, that – maybe I'm just too traditional. I don't know, but comes in that classroom setting and that discussion.
Well, I want to ask you about that. I mean, do you have a Facebook account?
Yes.
Do you use email and GChat and text
yes.
messages to communicate with your friends and
do,
have
yes.
conversations?
I don't, however, I don't have Internet at my apartment right now. So.
Well, that's interesting. But, I mean, could you envision possibly a structure in which you were able to actually take your classroom discussions online?
Potentially, like I do see the potential for that, but I don't know. I feel like there's something about that human interaction. I mean, it's not to say that it's not human when it's over the Internet, but looking somebody in the eyes and like having that conversation, I feel like you lose something when it's Internet based. But
I think your intuition on that is totally correct, and I think research actually upholds that. What's interesting is that, you know, the Department of Education came out with a big study, like a big meta study of 1,000 studies of learning over the summer, and what they found was that online learning actually did better on average than just traditional courses, but what did best of all was a hybrid approach where you had face-to-face communication coupled with sort of online, whether it's tutoring modules and the cutting-edge kind of classroom structure that people are looking at is something where you as a student are responsible for taking in the information on your own time, whether that's watching videos or reading a text, and then you come in and you use the class time for discussion, just like you're saying.
Right.
So, you know, the class time can be really cut down, but it's very concentrated and focused. And a further example of kind of a hybrid approach is they've discovered really, really good effects with people who are assigned to work in a team together. They meet in person just once and get that face-to-face connection, it really improves their collaboration for the rest of the time. And they work together in a team almost as much as well as if they, you know, had been meeting in person the whole time. So I think with the hybrid approach, what you get is, you know, a lot more efficient use of resources, and you still get that elusive human connection. It doesn't have to be all one or all the other.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let's kind of shift to talking about Richard Ludlow and Academic Earth. Do you want to explain
mm-hmm.
who Richard Ludlow is?
Sure. So this is kind of an interesting story. Ludlow was an undergrad at Yale, and he was taking a linear algebra class, and he was looking around for, you know, extra help that wasn't actually available in the tutoring. You know, he didn't want to go to the tutoring center or whatever. So he looked online, and he found the MIT Open Courseware Consortium, which is MIT since 2001 has put 1,900 of its courses online, so the entire offerings can be found online for free. And you can get video, you can get tutorials, you can get audio lectures and outlines. And Ludlow thought this material was so great, but he knew that he and his friends didn't really know about it, or, you know, hadn't heard about it. Had you guys heard about it, by the way, before you started doing this?
No.
Yeah. So
I had.
Oh, good, good. But so anyway, so he started Academic Earth, and his idea is to have sort of a Hulu of academic content, you know, just a way to make it really nicely presented, really neat and organized and much easier to find, and also to have a revenue model so that universities that want to subsidize their course offerings online can do that as well.
And I just wanted to, you know, add something about Richard Ludlow. I've used Academic Earth, and it's beautifully presented. But one of the things that worries me, and, you know, it goes back to this claim about what is education. Well, it's many things for many people.
Right.
I'm in philosophy, and so I really see education as the development of the ability for somebody to think for themselves. I think the development of identity is tied into that. And I think it's really important to point out two things about Richard Ludlow. One is that when he went into the internet, right, and when he discovered the MIT OpenCourseWare, he had a specific goal in mind. He was working on a problem. He knew that he didn't know something, and he went into the internet looking for something very specific. And I just wanted to say that experience of going into the internet with a goal in mind, with an academic goal in mind, is a very, very different experience than just sort of surfing randomly and clicking this and being sort of led by the pages rather than by your own goal and your own reason why you're there. And it worries me because I am aware of students who, and I think the internet can be very addicting, that just they sort of click on things on Facebook and they're there for hours and they don't really have a specific goal in mind. I also wanted to point out that Richard Ludlow was inspired by Wendy Kopp, who's one of my role models as well. She's the founder of Teach for America. Mm-hmm. And he saw what she was doing for education with her vision, and he wanted to do sort of like the same thing. So I just wanted to make that point. But especially, like, the more important point is that it's a very different educational experience when you go into the internet with a very specific academic goal in mind.
It worries you to see the idea that, you know, this passive kind of surfing would be substituted for, like, a real educational experience.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think a lot of people are going into the internet. They start out in there with social media. I don't know if you guys, the students here, want to disagree or agree with me, but my experience here at this university is that very few students are aware of the academic potential of the internet. They're not aware of all the educational podcasts. I mean, I am because I'm a professor, but the students are typically not. They're not aware of these things, and their experience with the internet, at least here at CMU with my students, it's social media. I mean, do you agree, disagree with that?
I 100% agree.
I would actually put that to you as a challenge as a professor, Hope. I mean, I think that it is the role of professors in the new age to aggressively embrace these technologies and to teach students how to use them and to teach students how to manage their own attention, you know, metacognitive skills where you're thinking about your own thinking processes. How do you stay on focus? How do you stay on task? How do you decide what information is relevant or important to you or, you know, is going to help you in your quest? And what I actually see, unfortunately, is that a lot of traditional universities are falling down. It's a dereliction of duty, I think, in this day and age for students to have a laptop, you know, a face-down policy with no laptops in the classroom. They're not supposed to use social media. They're not supposed to use cell phones. These things are being kept artificially separate from the curriculum. And students really need their professors' help. They need that guidance, and they need because it's really in the combination of the new media that's out there and the existing institutions that we have. I think that the real rocket fuel potential is out there for technology to bring learning and bring education to another dimension. And so, you know, stuff like what you're doing right now, you know, making a podcast with your students, that is what should be typical out there with the use of media in education.
Oh, I totally agree. But let me just throw this other thing out there. I just finished, you know, 5 years of going to law school and then 3 months of taking a bar review class that cost $3,000.
Wow.
Where I went to law school, the credit, each credit is over $1,000. And here's the thing, like, I do have a no-laptop policy, yet I embrace the educational potential of the internet. And the reason why I have a no-laptop policy is because as a student, as a law student, I saw people in class surfing during class time. And the thing is that it's habit-forming, and you get to this point where you get bored. Like, there's a point at which you get bored in class, and so people will check their cell phone, and they'll text somebody. and they don't push through that boredom. They don't push through that boredom and regain their attention. And I always explain why no laptops, but I really think that there's some, like, habit-forming addictive nature to how students are using the Internet and social media. And I think that until their love of learning and they're taking that seriously is properly awakened, I don't want to, you know. But people have to do blogs in my class. I podcast my class. So I am encouraging them to look at the Internet not just as a vehicle for social media, but it's very, very difficult because of the habit-forming nature of the Internet and because they're so accustomed to using it in this social way to do battle with that in a class. I'm like, you've seen the classrooms here, Anna. You've been here. It's like,
right.
You know, we're talking, you know, Germany. I mean, it's very industrial. It's not conducive to learning. It's uncomfortable. You're looking at the backs of heads. It just does not conduce, and it's tough to hold their attention.
I think it's a double-edged sword, right? We all perceive technology in our lives to be both a tool and sometimes something we struggle against, and I certainly have that feeling as well. It's really interesting. I was recently at this open education conference in Vancouver, you know, and it was about 200 people who were really cutting-edge educational technologists from all over the world, India, Brazil, China, Kenya, you know. And what they were doing, you know, they were doing a pretty, you know, they had in-person presentations, a lecture format, just like you might find, you know, in any university anywhere. And then every single person in the room had a laptop open, and every single person was Twittering along with the presentation. So they would be, you know, they're communicating, they're doing side conversations, they're dipping into comments on what's going on in the next room because there's simultaneous presentations. There are people from around the world who are watching the live stream of the presentation, and they're chiming in with comments. I mean, it was hectic. I'm not going to lie. Like, it was hard to keep your mind on what was going on at some moments, but at other moments, you really found this is what the potential of social media can do. You can amplify the conversation, you know. And what the thing that I found was most fascinating was that the best presenters at that conference were the ones that managed to break through the noise and really get people to focus on them, you know, for a few minutes at a time. But you know, we can't all bring our A game all the time. And the fact that social media was being used to enhance the quality of the presentations and not just as a distraction, I found very inspiring.
Do you guys want to follow up on that at all?
I mean, I think that's interesting to use it in that format, but I also think it's, you have to be well disciplined in order to use that social media as a constructive academic means.
So, were the people at this conference, were they mostly educators?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
See, and that's the difference.
I'm not so sure I agree with you because I think that it has to do with the practice and how comfortable they are with using technology and the fact that it wasn't banned, you know, it was embraced. I mean, I think it's difficult, right? Like I said, sometimes it's a tool and sometimes it is a terror, and it really is up to each one of us to mediate how we use technology so that it doesn't, interfere with the way we're conducting our lives. But I think, I mean, the flip side of it as well, you know, is that if you're in a lecture with a boring lecturer who's not bringing it, you know, why wouldn't you just be at home either watching that person on a live stream or watching a video of someone who's presenting the same information in a much better way? I mean, that's what the Internet really offers you.
Does anybody want, Sandra, do you want to comment to that?
No, go ahead.
Well, at the risk of sounding like an old fogey, I'm going to put it out there. And again, you know, I went to law school again. As a professor, and I had some horrible professors, and I was in a horrible bar review class. But I still think, you know, it worries me that we are catering to the sort of like, it worries me that there's almost like a consumer model of the student here, and that one of the things that I believe we should be doing in higher education, this is my, you know, specific view of it, is helping people to cultivate their appetites and desires and their discipline. And discipline is only cultivated when you're in, quite frankly, a boring situation or you're with a boring book and you are, like, forcing your will to stay there and be with it. And I think that that's a very valuable skill to practice. Going back to Aristotle, that is the only way. Like, when you actually are faced with this discomfort and you push yourself to deal with the discomfort, that you actually develop certain virtues of character. So, for example, courage you can only develop by being very, very frightened, but
mm-hmm.
nevertheless going on to the battlefield. And it worries me that there are these that we're sort of losing that with education. And I think that there are benefits, patience, attention, concentration, that can be cultivated even when you're in a very, very boring class. Like, you can really use it as an opportunity to cultivate attention.
It did not occur to me that someone would defend boredom, but you're totally right. I had not thought about that as a possible defense for boredom. I do have to say, though, that, it shouldn't be something that should excuse, weak teaching, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or teaching that is just, the person who's making the lecture from their same notes they've been using for 20 years. I mean, I don't think that it should be used to excuse that. And I think that technology, it's not going to improve, it's not going to substitute for an excellent teacher. But something that technology does have the potential to do is to substitute for the lowest common denominator of teaching, and also to bring teaching to people who currently do not have access to it. Because that's really what we're talking about at the bottom line. We're talking about, a fifth of young people around the world who are enrolled in higher education. That's four-fifths that are not. And in the U.S., you have 80% of students who are at non-selective institutions that have, very much varying in quality, half of all undergraduates that are at community colleges. And so the idea is, can you use technology and the ability to freely reproduce, whether it's audio, video, podcast, lectures, to freely reproduce the best teaching, some dimension of it, not the full dimension, not the full attention of a teacher, but some dimension of knowledge to get out there to as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm. Sure, and I also like going back to this claim, defending boredom. perhaps it's me, perhaps it's not, perhaps it's a combination of, the industrial room that we're in and the discomfort of the room itself. But I've experienced moments where I'm talking about things that I believe, because I'm an old fogey who actually, thinks that Aristotle was correct, that, things like human rights and liberty and, justice are things that young people, quite frankly, all people get excited about.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, people will sleep through it. And so one question is, if people are bored, the question is, why are they bored? And it could be that the love of learning, the realization of how important that information is to every human being has not been properly processed by that individual. So it's not just a case of boredom, but it's also a question of why they're bored. Why is there, if Aristotle says, first sentence of the Metaphysics, all men by nature desire to know. What Aristotle is saying is that there's an innate desire for human beings to know. Yet there are people cheating. There are people who don't do the reading. There are people who are sleeping during class. There are people who don't take seriously. So what's going on? To me, that is something that bothers me. And I look at technology as a tool by which that those things can actually be awakened and stimulated. So I just wanted to make that point.
Go ahead,
Anya. No, please go ahead.
I think that possibly that may not be boredom. That may just be poor time management.
Mm.
As a recent graduate of CMU, there are many classes that weren't necessarily boring, but I so felt like I was going to fall asleep in because I either got, 2 hours of sleep the night before or for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
So, just to
sure,
point.
There's all different reasons.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I think that student disengagement is a problem with a lot of causes, and, one of them is the commodification of education, this idea that you have to get a degree to get a good job, students are working more hours, they have more responsibilities. There's different, the population that's in college now is different than the population that was 30 years ago or 40 years ago when, less than half of the it was just, pretty much limited to white males and limited to a small percentage of them. So, the problem is not just providing higher education at an affordable cost, but it's mass higher education and indeed even universal higher education. And that is something that, no civilization has ever really either reached or even really contemplated before, I think, the United States in the post-war era. And so, it really is kind of a new thing under the sun. And technology is not the silver bullet. It's one one tool in our arsenal, as you say, you know, I think, but it is something that challenges the traditional means of delivering higher education in a way that can be, I think, very beneficial as we, you know, start to go through it and ask what is valuable about this, what do we need to change?
Anya, I mean, do you personally have a belief about, before you said education is many things to many people, but do you have a belief about, like, sort of the core mission of higher education, or do you think that's basically up for grabs?
That's a really interesting question. I'm pushing it and evolving my own understanding of it through this project. I think that I came into it with a lot of unconscious assumptions. You know, I came from a very collegiate family. My father went to Yale, my grandfather went to Columbia, I went to Yale, my sister went to Yale. So, you know, I had a lot of reverence for higher education as an institution and the traditions of higher education. And I think what I'm coming to discover now, frankly, higher education and universities, this is something that a sociologist named John Meyer at Stanford talked about. He said that higher education, the university project is really the project of rationality. You know, it's a civilization-long project. It does date back to Aristotle. It's really the core belief that, you know, human reason has something to say, that human reason can act on the world in a way that's transformational. That's rationality, and the university is really the cathedral of the rational religion that we are all sort of, whether we know it or not, we're all kind of conscripted into that religion by virtue of living in modern society. And so, you know, given that, you know, I think that's the case at the broadest level, you know, it doesn't necessarily say that the institution is supposed to be a totality, but it does need to be committed to this, to promulgating this rationalistic idea. And that's really, I mean, that's as far down as I can boil it down to.
And I just want to say, you know, going back to Aristotle, it's a point that we've made on this show before. I think it's very important to point out that Aristotle actually distinguished between two different types of rationality. There's the contemplative rationality, which I think is really dominating higher education. That's sort of like sitting and contemplating, like on a mountain, a philosopher. And then there's what he calls practical reason, which actually is connected with action. And
right.
You're starting to see, I don't know if I, when you were here, we talked about that book that the Carnegie Foundation for Teaching has recently published called Educating Citizens. But what they argue is that really what higher education needs to be doing is cultivating a type of practical rationality so that students are prepared to live lives of civic engagement in a democracy. So there's more like emphasis on service learning, and you're seeing that in higher education. And I just want to say, like, going back to your claim that, you know, higher education has not really caught up to this potential of technology and the internet, I also want to say that higher education is also slow to catch up to this idea that education should really be about, you know, preparing students for lives of sort of action, meaningful action, action in which people are engaged with their community. It's happening, you know, there are points of light, but it's
right.
Slow because I think we're so steep in this contemplative reason tradition. So on that
I wanted
note,
to...
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry. Well, I wanted to just quickly, if I could, present a slightly alternative view. I mean, some of the ideas that I'm exploring in the book have to do with the idea that... you know, that the purpose of education should really be in the hands of the learner, and that, you know, it shouldn't be that someone is at the mercy of institutions to tell them what the purpose of education is supposed to be, but really a radically decentralized and learner-centered view of education that, you know, is made easier by the internet and the, you know, sort of non-hierarchical organizing structures of the internet. So that's an alternative view of it as well.
And Aristotle would disagree.
absolutely, yeah.
Because, you know, the tradition that he's coming from is that there's basically human flourishing, and it depends on what a human being is and what the capacities are, and that there is an objective fact of the matter of what human flourishing is, and that it has to do with the awakening of certain fundamental human capacities, and the failure to awaken those capacities is to be, well, subhuman, and for Aristotle, women were by nature unable to awaken those capacities. But on that note, let's shift to the last part of the show. We've got 20 minutes left, and Sandra is going to segue into the discussion about the, and we've sort of been talking about it, but like the perils of the internet. And
right. I know we touched on it already, but just to go back to the potential perils of the internet, do you yourself, Anya, see any potential dangers arising from this marriage of the internet and higher education?
Sure. Well, I think that the number one thing that people fear is that we're going to see a further commodification of higher education. So, you know, the for-profit sector in higher education is the one that's been the strongest in promulgating this online-only learning. They're also the fastest-growing sector of higher education, and there's news recently that they're growing even faster in this economic downturn because they're lending money directly to their students, private loans. So that's, you know, that's worrisome to people that believe that higher ed has a purpose beyond preparing people for the workforce. You know, for-profit higher ed is more expensive for students than public higher ed, and it's much more limited in its goals. So, you know, so that's one thing to put out there. A second sort of issue, obviously, though, is that, you know, from an institutional point of view, I think institutions are worried that they're going to lose their monopoly over accreditation and indeed over knowledge and curriculum, because people, you know, can see from the resources available on the internet that no university can be all things to all people. So I think that, you know, that might be a danger from an institutional point of view. It may not be a danger to the learner.
So apart from sort of dangers that the commodification presents, do you see any sort of like developmental effects on like the individual? Because there's some work coming out that suggests that the type of reading that's done on the internet is like a very superficial type. I mean, do you agree with that sort of criticism, that apart from like the system of education, that when we just focus on like the individual, presenting education this way can have very, very dramatic changes in the way we think and process information?
Well, I think that we have to distinguish, you know, sort of the type of casual use of the internet that we use from its incorporation as learning, learning modules, tutoring modules within a very specific classroom setting. And going back to this idea that, you know, you're using the internet for very specific reasons, I think that we're all subject to the distractions of the internet, and the more we are able to use it in a focused way and learn how to use it and learn how to observe our own use of it, I think the more effective we're all going to be, because that engagement with the internet is not something that's going away. And furthermore, you know, if you look at things like the Open Learning Initiative, for example, at Carnegie Mellon University, they are actually finding much faster intake of information and much longer retention of information through the use of very structured computer programs to teach. And so, you know, it's different from just like searching the internet to read. It's a very, again, structured and controlled use of online technologies.
But yeah, I guess I never thought about it that way in terms of knowledge being a free thing and the ability of the internet to bring that to people in the lower margin. So I agree with you. I think that's a really revolutionary thing. It's cool.
I also, one of the things you mentioned was like how the internet would kind of, you know, has the possibility of taking away the university's monopoly on accreditation. And I think how beautiful that would be, I mean, to take away that and like see who really, you know, is intrinsically desires to go to an institution, you know.
Right. Well, that's a beautiful thing. I totally agree with you. There's an institution called Western Governors, which is a private accredited university that, you know, it was founded by the governors of 17 Western states. And what they have done is they've designed an entire course, sequence of courses. They have about, you know, I think a couple dozen undergraduate majors, and they're all assessment-based. So they went and they created a series of competencies that they thought that people would have to know to be, let's say, in business or in, you know, an IT consultant or a nurse or an education major. And then the assessments are sort of timed, you know, qualitative and quantitative tests. And if you can pass the assessment, you don't have to take any course information. You can take courses from them. You can take, you know, self-paced course modules. But they also had a person who got a bachelor's degree in 6 months because he'd been working as an IT consultant for 15 years. He just never had the coursework. And so, you know, this is the kind of thing that I think that the internet allows people to do, to deliver education in a completely different way and to give people credit for life experience.
So on our website, there's an article that we posted called "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" Maybe you saw it, Anya. But would you agree that the reading that's done on the internet and the thought patterns that this encourages hinder the kind of deep thinking and reflection that is the aim of higher education?
Well, I mean, I would, you know, obviously the point I made earlier, you know, there's different aims for different people at different times with higher education. And sometimes it's deep thinking and reflection. I also think that, you know, the kind of reading that we all do, you know, we're going to be doing increasing amounts of our reading in a hypertext environment. And I think that the aim of higher education in today's, you know, day and age should really be to equip students to deal with that the best that they can. And whether that means, you know, gaining the insight into your own thinking processes to know when you're wandering off task. You know, that is something that maybe we need to explicitly teach. It didn't have to be explicitly taught before because the student was already isolated when they were, you know, in the library by themselves with books. But, you know, that kind of environment, you can create it artificially, but in the real world, you're going to have to learn how to deal with your own distraction, and that is something that I think colleges should be teaching.
One of the experiences I have, like, just the difference between, like, writing, like, you know, using Microsoft Word and typing on a typewriter, opposed to, like, having a notepad and, like, writing kind of like an outline of notes and, like, kind of having, like, weird little annotated stuff on the side that's, like, more meaningful to me. I don't know. To me, there just seems like this more personalization that happens when you're engaging it physically opposed to virtually. I mean, what do you think about that?
Oh yeah, I think that mind mapping is really cool. I think that, you know, I definitely draw pictures and diagrams and things to help me, and, you know, I don't always want to be in front of a screen. I think that, you know, it doesn't have to be a rigid either or. It can be very complementary. I mean, I think if you wanted to ask me, like, what I thought the future of higher education was really going to look like, I think that the top of the line higher education experience is going to combine the best of what the real world has to offer with the best of technology. And I think that the combinations are going to become increasingly seamless. And the lower end, you know, the more affordable math higher education is going to be more online only. There is going to be a dimension that's lost, but what's going to be gained is far cheaper access for far greater numbers of people.
I also kind of wanted to preface that question just by saying, like, I think technology is awesome, and I'm excited to see its integration, but, I mean, you kind of doing the research on this stuff, I kind of want to just, you know, throw the hardballs out there, kind of what I think, you know, the opposition to it. So,
no, I really appreciate actually the ability to talk it over with you guys, because it obviously seems that you think about it a lot, and, you know, you guys really represent the best of what traditional higher education has to offer right now. I mean, I see a lot of students who are really languishing because of lack of access to resources, and you know, frankly, I think that a lot of institutions do a disservice to their students, because if you don't, you know, if you don't have the money to hire the best teachers, and if your teachers are uninspiring and uninspired, you know, is it really fair to your students to deny them the free lectures by the best lecturers in the world when those are available to anyone out there? You know, why not use them?
I'm just curious, Anya, what you think, and I know you touched on this a little bit, but if you could talk a little bit more about where you think the university is going. Because being at a school like CMU, I feel like what I perceive is it's becoming a kind of trade school, and it's no longer so much about, like, gaining knowledge as gaining skills so you can get the job, make the money, and pay back your debt. And
right.
I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that is absolutely true in aggregate. I think that the combination of the cost spiral, you know, tuition going up twice as much as inflation for 25 years, with this, you know, this middle class imperative that everybody needs to get a degree in order to earn a living wage, really leads you to an intolerable situation. It's not good for the quality of higher education. You know, the future of higher education, I think, is going to be, you know, it's going to be very complicated. It's going to be very diverse. I don't know that these situations are going to automatically resolve themselves. I think what I say in the book is that I think the impact of technology is going to be increasingly hard to ignore, and it's certainly going to have its impact in sort of the vocational areas of higher education. And where I think that advocates of you know, different means of higher education, you know, the liberal arts ideas and the ideals of contemplation, where they can really have impact right now as these things are changing is in aggressively embracing and leveraging technology for their own purposes and their own ends, so that, you know, you can have, for example, something like the Peer-to-Peer University, which is just launched, and they are a basically an online website where you can meet and aggregate with other people who are interested in learning using free resources and form small colloquiums, like little courses based around common themes of interest. And the only purpose of them is by personal enrichment. And these are types of things that are going to be, you know, very cheap or even free. They're lifelong learning types of activities. That is going to be the complement, I think, to the relentless pressures that we see from the economy to make higher education a cheaper commodity.
So yourself as a journalist and a writer, do you ever find the internet to be too distracting or a hindrance to this kind of solitude that writing demands?
I think that it's something that I have to manage and struggle with. I have to learn when to unplug.
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think we all do. You know, it's really overwhelming, the amount of information that's out there, and, you know, human brains and human bodies can only evolve so quickly. You know, the pace of our culture is moving much faster than we as individuals are moving. And so it really is something that we're going to have to grapple with. Just.
Anya, are you there?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay, if you cut out for a minute. The last
thing
you referred, like, grappling with.
Right.
So, yeah, with you just cut out for a minute, so I got a little bit nervous.
Sorry about that.
It's okay. I cut out completely last week, so things happen. But going back to this, you know, it's sort of overwhelming, the amount of things that are thrown at us, the amount of information. And I'm curious if you're familiar with are you familiar with any of Jim Collins' work? He wrote Built to Last and Good to Great. And these are books that were
– Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he talks about the hedgehog concept, which is – find your hedgehog, which is like sort of like the one thing. And his argument is that, you know, exemplary organizations, and I would also make the argument to people, about people as well, is that people are sort of like focused on one thing, that they're sort of aware of what their core mission is, and they do that.
And
I just think that it's so hard to do that when you have so many different things coming at you, and you're not really given the skills to discover what your core mission is in the first place. So I think that the internet can be used to help students discover that for themselves.
Sure, absolutely.
I also just like going back to Sandra's question about, you know, do you find it, is it a struggle to find these quiet spaces that writing demands? And I write too, and I found myself when I was writing that, you know, writing is hard. Just like going back to the boredom claim, sitting in class and paying attention for an hour and a half is hard. And you're sitting in the same seat, and it's hot, and you're looking at the back of everybody's head. It's hard to do it, and your instinct is to, like, flee from that difficulty and go check Twitter and go check email. And I mean, isn't it the case? I just want to, you know, hear you say it. But isn't it the case that, like, with writing, you've got to, like, push through those hard moments? You cannot let yourself be distracted. You've got to, like, stay there with the material and push through the hard moment. Do you agree with that claim?
Well, you know, I studied a little bit of meditation, and I find that, you know, in Vipassana meditation, you don't have a mantra to concentrate on, but what you do have is you just are gently turning the mind away. So you see that, you know, distractions are arising, and this is something that is not unique to the internet. It's just, you know, it's a function of being human, that, you know, you have a monkey mind. It's rushing from, you know, idea to idea. And what you do is you are not hard on the mind. And so there's been a teaching that, you know, that you don't want to bang your thoughts away because they're going to ricochet back and sort of hit you in the head. And what you really want to do is sort of gently gently direct your thoughts back to your breath or whatever it is that you're focusing on. And I really find that that helps for me as well in writing, that I don't have a lot of negative self-talk about getting distracted or trying to force myself to concentrate, but I really just try to gently refocus myself. And I actually find that, you know, for example, Twitter can be a help to me. This is the first time that I've been using Twitter for a few months, and sometimes I use it to help me when I'm writing. I'll post to my friends that I'm going to be writing for the next 45 minutes, and I'm going to try to hold myself to produce this many words. And that's a public commitment that I made to, you know, 500 people, whoever many it is, that I'm going to do it. And it really helps. People write back with little messages of support, or they say, how am I doing? Or I had a friend pop up on my G-chat yesterday and say, get back to work, Anya. You know, I know you're working. And so that actually, I find that can be really helpful. So, you know, these tools, they don't have to be our enemies all the time. They can actually be helpful for us sometimes.
Right. I think that's a really important point. And, yeah, studies do show that making this sort of public commitment actually increases the likelihood that you're going to do the thing that you commit to. And,
right.
The Internet, obviously, it affords us yet another way to make such a public commitment.
And it also, I mean, for my work in particular, since I'm a journalist and I'm writing for an audience and for a public, you know, the fact that I can connect with people in so many ways online and blogging and Twittering and Facebook, you know, it really helps me. It helps me remember who I'm writing for and, you know, what the questions are. It helps me get involved in conversations like this where it's clarifying, you know, my ideas and helping me decide what I'm going to say and what, you know, how I'm going to say it. So I actually find it to be, you know, it can be very much turned to my advantage, I think, as a writer, and I think for a lot of people it's the same. No matter how solitary your work ultimately is, it's also part of the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it must be. Your work should be a part of conversation. Otherwise, you might miss out on some really good stuff.
Right.
That's all I have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really important. And I think, you know, it's interesting, too, a lot of some of the technologies that I've been writing about have to do with allowing students to actually publish and share their work with the world. And, you know, something that has a lot of pedagogical value. For example, there's classes that people are teaching now where they'll have them write a research paper, but the research paper is actually a Wikipedia entry on a topic that hasn't been covered yet. And so, you know, they're actually getting to contribute to a community-produced encyclopedia. There are people out there that are, you know, passionate about whatever the topic is. In this class, it was obscure, you know, Colombian writers, and there were people who were part of that community that had feedback for the students. And, you know, so they're producing real work, and they're getting the opportunity to publish, which might have been, you know, denied to anyone except for, you know, career academics in previous decades.
In terms of one of, like, going back to your, like, strategy of, like, when you start to lose focus, gently bringing yourself back, like, with your self-talk, that's not something I really have practiced. I'm going to have to give that a try.
I'm definitely rough with myself. There's no gentle self-talk.
But,
yeah, no, I mean, I think, yeah, what about it?
I was going to ask, like, does it, When you're coming back into it, is it like this slow, calm state where you just kind of gradually come back into it? Like, because I find myself, like, when I, like, get the negative self-talk going, I'm like, do it, you know? Like, I get this intense rush, you know? Like, I'm rushing, you know? Whereas, like, I feel if I were to have this gentle kind of, like, pie in the sky, I don't know, I might just, like, not get anything done, I guess, you know, and especially, you know, in the case where you have a deadline, you know, and something's coming up fast, and you know, so I guess
I mean, you have to find
out.
You have to find the style that works for you, and there's no one style that works for anyone, but I think that, personally, I think that this kind of insight into your own knowledge processes is one of the most important things that maybe should be on the core curriculum that isn't, that people really need to know how they learn best, what's their best intelligence, and, you know, how to keep themselves on task. Because, you know, if you look at the gulf between, like, you know, say you have your long-term goal, right, which is to do well in college and graduate from college, but then your short-term goal is pretty much anything else, right? Everything gets in the way of that. And so how do you bring those big picture and the little picture into better alignment? And that is really something that we, you know, we all have to struggle with.
Yeah, and we have about 30 seconds left, and I just wanted to second what you're saying, Anya, that that is something that higher education has neglected. There are, however, some preschools that are doing it, the self-science curriculum, some schools out west in California.
That's interesting.
Self-science curriculum. They actually have concrete exercises which are designed to make the students mindful of their learning habits and so forth.
Right.
But at any rate, 18 seconds left, and thank you so much for the conversation, Anya. It was great.
Thank you, Anya.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and next week we will probably have a discussion continuing along the same lines about the Internet and the potential vices, and we're about out of time, and we're off the air. Don't talk to nobody and no one. But, Anya, are you still there?
Uh-huh, sure.
Okay. Yeah, so we're off. But, anyway, that's it. That's the end of the show.
Okay, great.
I cut off in the middle of my sentence. I guess that's good.
Anya, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for calling in.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Yeah. And email me when you want to talk, if you still want to talk.
Will do, yeah.
Okay?
I will, absolutely.
All right,
I'll
great.
Be in touch.
Thanks, Anya.
All right, bye.
All right, have a good night. Bye.
Bye.